the Young and Healthy podcast. You're listening to the Cincinnati Children's Young and Healthy podcast.
Hello and welcome back to the Cincinnati Children's Young and Healthy podcast. So glad you're with us today. I'm Kate Sutter, your host for today, and we are back with another episode within our infant series. And today we're going to be talking about tongue tie in babies. Joining me for this conversation today are Dr. Jenny McAllister, who is a general pediatrician who works in neonatology, and Marsha Lee Watson, who is a pediatric speech pathologist. Both of them are experts here at Cincinnati Children's, and I'm delighted to have them in the studio today. Thank you both for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Tongue tie is probably one of those that, people don't know about it until they have reason to know about it. And you both kind of are involved with families who are dealing with this from different angles. And Dr. McAllister, would you start with just kind of an introduction to you, your practice, and where you find yourself working with families of babies who have tongue tie?
Absolutely. And thank you for having this conversation, because I think it is an important one. As you mentioned, I'm a general pediatrician, and I do primarily my clinical work in the newborn hospitals around Greater Cincinnati. So we cover all of the kind of delivering hospitals in the area where we see the newborns, but our group also covers kind of the sicker babies in the NICU as well. I primarily focus on the well newborns, and additionally, I'm also a certified lactation consultant, so I have a special interest in breastfeeding. It's one of my passions, and also I work in the NICU follow-up clinic where I see some of these babies after they're discharged from the hospital for the first few years of life, specifically focusing actually on babies with prenatal opioid exposure.
Thank you for joining us. We're so glad you're here. And Marsha, will you tell us a bit about your practice and the kiddos that you see?
Sure. And again, thanks for having this conversation. I think it's going to be super helpful for some of these parents. I am a speech pathologist, and I primarily see patients with tongue tie related to their feeding issues. A restrictive tissue can make it really difficult for a baby to either nurse at the breast or get a good latch on a bottle. And certainly eating is primary for these babies to grow and develop, and these problems come in early. So I'm trying to be helpful to these families in determining how we can best work through these issues with this restrictive tissue, if it's present or not.
And so you might have just foreshadowed something there, Marsha, but sometimes in the conversation about tongue tie, lip ties also come into the conversation, and would love to start just kind of with what are these types of restricted tissue, and how common are they? Dr. McAllister, do you want to take that one?
Sure, I can start with that. So with both of these, what we call ties, they're also labeled like tethered tissues. There's a frenulum, which is the fancy word for that tissue that hangs or that connects the bottom of the tongue, or as you mentioned, the lip to the top of the gum. There's not really a lot of great evidence out there. There's a little bit of limited studies, but in the studies that we do know, the incidence of the tongue tie specifically ranges anywhere from about 4 to 12% in the literature. There is really no evidence about lip ties as far as the evidence. And if you look at just all newborns, most babies universally have that tissue that connects the lip to the top gum. Mm-hmm. We just don't know what abnormal is. So every baby has that. We just don't know if that's necessarily pathologic.
And that area that you're talking about with the lip tie is kind of like right on the very front of the gums, that if the baby has teeth, would be kind of in between those two front teeth connecting up. And I remember when one of my kids was little, it was pretty tight. I don't know that it interfered with feeding. But I remember a pediatrician saying, they're probably going to hit it on something and it's going to tear and it's going to bleed like crazy, but then it's going to kind of resolve itself. And so it definitely sounded like it was something that most babies have.
Yeah. And just following up on that, I would agree with that. Sometimes you can see gaps between the teeth and those actually sometimes get better as they get older, as that kind of tissue and that gum change over time. And so, again, that kind of goes back to not necessarily knowing what's normal versus abnormal.
And just with that lip, there are times that the lip tissue is exceptionally thick and exceptionally tight. Mm-hmm. And those situations, which are really rare, they can cause some issues with upper lip mobility, which can have some issues with create some issues with speech sounds, where they can't flare that upper lip and push it out. Again, those are rare occurrences, but certainly there are things that, as a clinician, it's good for us to really make sure that we're looking at all of that connective tissue in the mouth to see what's normal, what's not normal, and what is it doing to this patient's ability to function as we want them to function normally. And I always go back to that word function. If it doesn't impact their function, it's not a problem.
So let's talk a little bit about what some of those challenges are. What are kind of the first challenges with feeding that a family might see with a baby who has restrictive tissue?
Oftentimes, babies may have difficulty latching. So it's kind of sustaining that latch. They may be able to get on. And I'm going to kind of mostly talk specifically about breastfeeding, because I think that's where we see the majority of kind of our issues. Mm-hmm. They'll have a difficulty kind of latching to the breast itself or maintaining that latch. A lot of times, babies may be able to latch, but moms have a lot of nipple pain as a result of a tongue being kind of too restrictive. And I echo what Marcia said. It's kind of a functional-based kind of thing. So if they're able to latch that kind of function and move that tongue how they're supposed to, moms really shouldn't have a ton of pain or any damage to the nipple, which we can also see with a pretty restrictive tongue.
And Marcia, what about kiddos who maybe aren't breastfeeding or are trying to – you said sometimes babies who are using a bottle will also have challenges.
And a lot of it is it's that latch. It's that ability to get that tongue cupped so that it can get a nice seal around the nipple, and then they can extract the fluid from the bottle in a really efficient manner. And I think one of the challenges with some of the breastfeeding moms with the pain is that the babies start using a little bit more of a bite to try to get the milk from the breast, because that tongue is not functioning, because of the restrictive tissue, it just isn't functioning well to help pull that milk from the breast. So a lot of it becomes just looking at what does that tongue do and how much can it move to get a good latch.
Can it be involved in the swallowing motion? Can there be concerns there with babies who have this?
I think in most cases, because I do a lot of feeding therapy, I think in most cases it doesn't affect the swallow function. It really is more in that what we call the oral part of that swallow process. And it's really just getting the fluid from the breast and or the bottle into the mouth. Once they get it in there, I think the posterior part of the tongue most of the time can do its job efficiently enough to propel the fluid back, but it doesn't necessarily affect the swallow function.
If we have a parent who thinks that this might be going on with their baby, what are some of the specific signs that they should look for that would indicate a concern that would be worth following up on?
I think some of the things that we've already mentioned. So if they're having difficulty breastfeeding, maintaining that latch, if mom's having nipple pain, and I think this is probably pretty obvious in those first few days, even those first few latches, you may kind of have an inkling that maybe something with the latch isn't quite right, and whether it's positioning or whether it's the tongue, certainly we would advocate for lactation help or somebody to kind of assess that latch to see what's really going on and whether the tongue is contributing to some of these difficulties.
And with a new mom who maybe doesn't know what a good latch feels like or looks like, I think that there's those first few days are just so hard and I don't know what I'm doing. Is the pain, like if it hurts trying to breastfeed, is that a good one to go on to say, okay, maybe something isn't right and I need some help?
That's a great question. And I think breastfeeding, even though we always say it's natural, it's hard. And we all know that. And I think that's probably why we're here, right? Like a lot of women don't meet their breastfeeding goals because it is so difficult. Breastfeeding shouldn't be painful. It may be uncomfortable. I think we all have different, you know, levels or thresholds of pain, but it shouldn't be biting, like Marcia mentioned, or pinching. The nipple itself after a baby comes off the breast should be pretty round. It shouldn't be creased like a new tube of lipstick. That's a concern that maybe that baby is either shallow on the breast for either a positioning issue or potentially a tongue issue, but that latch isn't quite right. And in the hospital, we do a lot of work to kind of assess this. So, you know, it's a busy time. You just had a baby. Your body has changed. And we're trying to breastfeed this baby that, you know, doesn't know what they're doing. But there's lots of help. We have lactation consultants in the hospital. All our nurses are trained in breastfeeding. You know, certainly the physicians and the pediatricians are looking at the baby. And so hopefully within those even first few latches, first few feeds, you have an idea of kind of things that you can work on and tweak. And so hopefully before the time that you leave the hospital, some of these issues have been addressed. And we're really working, at least in the Cincinnati region, to kind of specifically look at that as well.
So my next question, maybe Marcia, I'll come to you first, is are all tongue ties the same and do they all cause problems?
I would say no and no. Tongue ties are just like anything else. We can have a nice range of what that looks like. And so probably one of the most significant type of a tie would be if you look at a baby and they're crying and that tongue kind of has a cupped look to it. But at the very front edge of that tongue, you can see that lighter color, almost string-like looking tissue that adheres it to the floor of the mouth. And you can see that attachment really close to the tip of the tongue. That would be a more severe case, which might really restrict that tongue movement for nursing or bottle feeding. There are times that connective tissue is a little farther back. And certainly it's really all about function. So even if it's attached a little bit closer to the tip, if the child still has the ability to latch, to move that tongue when they get a little bit older, into some of the movements that are required for later feeding and even for some speech work, then we don't worry so much about that. But just because you can see that connective tissue doesn't mean that it's a functional restriction for that child.
I absolutely agree with all of that. But I think the hard part is, as Marcia mentioned, is that there can be a continuum or variation for how far that frenulum or that tissue comes out. But assessing whether that function is impairing it is difficult. And so as pediatricians and when I did training, I never received any education about what a normal tongue looks like, what it's supposed to have, you know, even breastfeeding in general. And so because I felt pretty passionate about this and given my breastfeeding background, we kind of undertook this as a division of neonatology as a quality improvement project. And what we were really hoping is to answer exactly what you asked, like, how do we know this is impairing breastfeeding, and how do we know that the tongue may be an issue? And so what we actually recently launched last year was a quality improvement initiative to assess for tongue tie. We use an assessment score called the TABI tool, which is both anatomic assessment as well as a function-based assessment. And based on what that frenulum looks like, as well as how far either the tongue can move up or cup around, like Marcia said, a baby will get a score. And we are actually trying to score every single baby that delivers at the hospitals that we cover so that we have a number or a more objective measure as to what the tongue tie is. Now, if they have a score of 8 is perfect, normal. Score of 0 is, as Marcia mentioned, all the way to the tip. You can't really move that tongue at all. It's kind of fixed heart shape with that cleft at the end. Based on the literature, a score of like 5 or less shows that there's probably some functional impairment, that they may have some difficulty with feeding or breastfeeding. 6-7 is kind of that borderline. And so we really take in account of what does mom feel? How do we think baby's transferring milk? Is the baby losing weight? Kind of more information that we take in consideration. And so I think this has really empowered us to say, like, this may or may not be an issue. It's not perfect, but at least it's some type of objective measure that it's just not guessing as to whether or not this is impairing babies. And so this is one of the first projects of its kind that we've heard of, and we're actually presenting some of this information at some of the conferences to really show that, yes, we agree with everybody out there saying that this could potentially impact breastfeeding, and how do we, as medical professionals, really address this in a more evidence-based manner so that we can have some data to support kind of what we're doing and what our next steps may be.
I love that you're working on the objective measure, which is amazing. And like in so many other ways, we're thinking ahead here in Cincinnati. So if we're reaching somebody who is kind of outside of our region and doesn't have medical professionals who are kind of part of this work, who is going to be the right next person for them to see? You'd mentioned lactation consultants are an amazing resource. And are pediatricians another good place to go to say, hey, I think something might be going on here?
I mean, I think it's always a good idea to see your pediatrician if you have difficulty feeding or any questions. I will say, I think it really depends on the experience, I think, of some of our colleagues and how much education they've gotten, because I do think this is an area in which there's not a lot of education that's maybe been provided. But there are some really great national guidelines and professional guidelines and resources that even if you did see a professional that may not be as familiar, that they could kind of utilize some of their resources. So the Academy of Breastfeeding Medicine has a nice statement piece or protocol on that. The American Academy of Pediatrics is actually in the process of revising their statement piece. So I do think there's resources for those medical professionals. And I'm sure Marcia would probably say some, definitely, you know, lactation consultants, but speech pathologists as well.
And certainly speech can look at these, the babies, their early feeding and just ability to move their tongue around just to do some normal oral play that a baby might do. Another professional that certainly could be brought in are our ENTs. That certainly could be part of the process. And if a child has a restrictive tissue and it's affecting their function, that would be another assessment that should be looked into to determine whether or not there's a need and it's justified and it makes sense based upon the rest of the child's medical history, whether or not a release is a good option. There certainly are some cases that releasing that tissue could be more detrimental than not releasing that tissue. And that's why it should be a team approach. This should not be a one-man show. As the old expression goes, it really should be how can we take information from, you know, the neonatologist or the in the birthing hospitals and the pediatrician and get the speech person involved and then bring all of this information together. And it has to happen in a fairly short period of time because these babies need to eat. So this isn't something that can go on for months and months. In trying to support these families, we need to get on this quickly. But again, I think our ENTs are certainly key. And they have really done some really great studies on trying to look at information and getting their statements of care updated and integrated. So,
I agree with that totally. And ENT was one that we actually refer to their protocol as well. I love the idea of referring to ENT, especially if you're not in the community in which your physician in the hospital has the ability to take care of a tongue tie at the time of birth. I think ENT is probably your best option in the community or where if your general pediatrician isn't able to take care of it. Because not only can they assess, but they can also potentially intervene if necessary. But I do certainly echo that multidisciplinary approach. Just because you maybe release it or not, you still need that help with lactation or speech, depending on what the primary issue is, to figure out how to use that tongue in an appropriate manner.
And if I could kind of piggyback on that, you know, one of the things that as I assess babies that have families that have a concern that their baby has a restrictive tissue, there are times that I don't see a restrictive tissue, but I see a tongue that really isn't really efficient at what it's doing. And this is definitely going to be in a little bit of an older child, not our babies. Mm-hmm. But there are times that I will do some exercises and try to get that tongue movement into a little more functional avenue, just because as children are trying to figure out how to move their tongue, they don't necessarily know to get it from the center to the corner of their mouth and then back to the other side. Mm-hmm. But we can, you know, do some little activities with them that we can start working on getting a little bit better tongue movement, and then getting that tongue tip elevated. Babies, again, we can't do that so much with the babies. We're worried about getting them eating. Mm-hmm. But our older kids, there certainly are things we can do, but it doesn't necessarily mean they have to have a release to get to that end outcome.
I wish there were a way we could teach our babies how to move those tongues efficiently and tell them to do exercises, because I totally agree. And I think sometimes when they're born, those tongues just don't move the way they're supposed to. And it's not necessarily because of a tight tissue. Sometimes they have lots of amniotic fluid and other things that's really contributing to that oral, not necessarily aversion, but think, you know, just not wanting to suck appropriately. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's in utero, kind of the way they're positioned and different things like that.
So talking about the ENT and a release, I believe that release procedure is called a frenotomy. Is that correct?
Yes.
And so I do want to talk a little bit more about that, but that is one treatment option. Are there other treatment options that are available if there's a kiddo who needs it, or is it kind of we try working with Marsha or one of her colleagues first, we try all of the non-surgical things, and then that's kind of the treatment if it's needed? Or how do you guys think about kind of treatment in this space?
I'll speak mainly to the hospitalization or the birth hospital process. A frenotomy, which is that release, is a really actually pretty minor, simple procedure. The gold standard way to do it is really just to elevate the tongue and with a sharp scissors clip that little bit of connective tissue that we talked about. The risks are pretty low, pretty minimal. Oftentimes, babies don't necessarily, I mean, we can't objectively measure pain, but I've done lots and lots of these, and they don't even flinch sometimes. Bleeding is always a risk in the mouth, but that's basically it. And so it's a pretty minor procedure for potentially pretty, in my opinion, decent outcomes if we're talking about feeding, right? If it's mother's success or willingness to continue breastfeeding, if it's baby's ability to latch, which, you know, this is what babies have to do. This is their job. They have to eat. And so based on kind of that TABI assessment, if we're a 5 or less, which we think there's function impairment as well as anatomic issues, I will almost always offer it in the hospital. Certainly it's a shared decision between mm-hmm. parents and the providers as to kind of risks, benefits. I kind of sometimes defer to our speech pathologists about, depending on severity, may or may not interfere with kind of speech formation down the road. But I do offer it in the hospital. And I think that's what we're really trying to do with this quality improvement work, because as Marsha mentioned, this isn't something we want months and months to take. This is something that we want it done and for them to figure out how to use that tongue again once it is released, if we feel like that's needed, rather than trying therapy or trying other things. This is something that a baby needs to survive if it comes down to what type of feeding they're doing.
And certainly, yeah, the babies are definitely different than our older mm-hmm. kids. These babies need to eat. And it really does go back to that as the core. For some of the older kids, so one of the things that we know is that even a restricted tongue, even a fairly significantly restricted tongue, doesn't always have and doesn't usually have a significant impact on speech productions. There certainly are those cases. We can always identify those rare cases where a child's tongue was so super restricted and they couldn't get a lot of movement of that tongue, and it certainly had an impact on their speech. I think we probably would see a little bit more in their ability to manage eating solid foods because that tongue doesn't have mm-hmm. a good mobility as opposed to a function of their speech. I think any time that we can do therapy and we can work through things with these children that are a little bit older, and not have them go through a surgical procedure, I think that's always best. Anytime we can do something that we don't have to put them in the operating room for a minor procedure, that's always the best outcome. There are times that we'll try therapy services. We don't get the outcome that we're looking for. Sometimes we have to go to that next step and talk to the ENTs about what else do we need to do here.
That makes sense. And so if we have a baby who has the frenotomy during hospitalization, like right after birth, what typically happens next?
The recovery is minimal, basically nothing. They can go right to the breast. They can feed right away. I do think working with lactation afterwards to really kind of help with positioning and managing that latch as best as possible is important. But there's really not a lot of recovery time. I think it's kind of that's pretty much it after the procedure. I will echo a little bit about what Marcia said about, you know, trying different things. So before I would just go in and say, I'm going to clip this tongue, I would say, have you worked with lactation? What have we tried? You know, it's not that we're not trying other non-interventional things first, but if I have a score of 2 where I know that tissue is all the way to the tip, I think there very little we'll be able to do with just positioning and other latch techniques that are going to help with that.
And then at that point, it's like, let's take care of it so this baby can
absolutely
eat comfortably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And honestly, you know, the birth hospitalization, as crazy as that time is, sometimes you're out in 24 hours, 48 hours, right? And that may be only, you know, 6 to 8 feeds, maybe slightly longer. And so you're not having a ton of time to really truly assess what's going on. And so I do think kind of follow up with lactation or your pediatrician or, you know, if you are having significant feeding issues is important to maintain that continuity to make sure things are continuing to be successful.
And so, Marcia, with older babies, perhaps ones that were able to feed well enough during infancy and have made it through to, you know, slightly older kids, can there be kind of longer-term feeding issues that could crop up from the same, you know, restrictive tissue that the child was born with?
Certainly. So if the child's restricted tissue was released when they were a baby, in most cases, we don't see any issues ongoing past that. There are times that a tissue will be looked at and by a provider and go, well, it's probably okay. And as a child grows, there could be some issues with that ability to move that tongue for solid foods. But part of it comes down to, is it a functionality? Is it a movement issue? Or is it a restrictive tissue issue? And again, I think we need to look at all of those pieces to determine, do we need to do some therapy to work on this? But it can have an impact on their ability to move the food from the center of their mouth over to their teeth to chew those foods up and then get that food back to the center of their tongue so that they can swallow it.
Are there any misconceptions surrounding tongue ties that we should take a couple of minutes to discuss and dispel?
I don't know if misconceptions is the right word, but I do think tongue ties are blamed or are thought to be the reason for a lot of breastfeeding difficulties, which may or may not be the case. And I think this has really come of light in the last several years, especially just in the last few months with the New York Times article out kind of talking about kind of the frenzy of frenotomies. Breastfeeding is hard, as I mentioned. I think a lot of us struggle and don't meet our goals. And I do think if there was kind of a magic bullet in which said, you know, if you just take care of this, it's going to get so much better. And I think as, you know, when we would do anything to kind of to help with this, I think that's kind of where this has fallen. And also, I think social media has really blown up the hype, I guess, about tongue ties without a lot of evidence to support it. And I think that's where I, as a clinician, always come back to is, well, is there evidence to support what we do? And so I don't think releasing a tongue tie is the be-all, end-all. Kind of along that same line, there are different ways to release a tongue tie or restriction. And as I mentioned, the kind of the, just that sharp scissors gold standard way to do it without a lot of side effects or downsides or potential complications. There are other ways in which people release them, including laser therapy, which can potentially sometimes cause more harm than damage. There can be potentially thermal injuries, oral abrasions, and things like that. Sometimes they go back and do revisions, which is not always, I think, pleasant for the baby. So I think there's, within the age of social media, there's a lot of hype without the evidence. And I think that's where we really struggle kind of being in the middle of it.
I think a misconception can go into one little notch of this. I think that when you have a family or a parent that looks at their child's tongue and they'll look underneath and they'll say, but I can see it. I can see that connective tissue. It doesn't mean that it's restrictive just because you can see it. And just because you can see it doesn't mean something has to happen with that tissue. We all have a frenum. It's under our tongue. We have them under our upper and lower lips as well. And as long as they are able to allow our tissues to do what those tissues are supposed to do, there's really no reason to do something with that tissue. Social media certainly has been big. I'm going to say the last 8 to 10 years, mm-hmm. it's been really big. And again, I think we have to look at each case individually. I don't think we can take a whole anecdotal list of evidence from social media and apply it to a child and say, okay, so this child just needs to have a frenectomy or frenotomy, excuse me. I think if there's an impact on the child's function, certainly we need to look at what else could we do? What else should we do? What's the next step that makes sense? And educate the family on, let's give these things a try. Let's try this. Give them some really good tools to use at home. Do some follow-up with the family and then take the next step that might be appropriate, whatever that is. And it doesn't necessarily mean that tissue needs to be released. It might just mean some more home programming and some more exercises and activities to do at home. Sometimes it's therapy that, okay, so the home programs helped a little bit, but let's do some more formal therapy and work on that in the office.
And I will say, kind of Marcia touched on this, that there's other frenulums or connective tissues in your mouth. That's just how our mouths are designed and made, and the majority of them are not abnormal. So we mentioned the lip. There's also something called a buccal tie, which I'll just throw out there, is it's where your cheek attaches to your gum. That is absolutely normal. There is no reason that those need to be released or taken care of. There's no evidence that shows that interferes with feeding and, to my knowledge, speech as well. No. And so I would just, you know, if I were a parent out there who is looking for help and, you know, may have gone to some of these resources, just kind of think about that. Like, you know, what are people offering you? What are the additional services? Are they offering therapy? Are they offering lactation with it? Or is it just this release with other things? And that should, in my mind, be a little bit of a red flag.
I think what's interesting to me about the social media world is that it's one family's account of what worked for them. And I always get a little bit nervous when people make a decision based on individuals' accounts instead of seeking the help of professionals who have seen countless cases that are all a little bit different, but coming to professionals like you all, your colleagues across the country, our ENT colleagues as well, you have these like vast clinical practices that help you help a family. And that's, I mean, even as somebody who is not clinical, I cringe a little bit when somebody's like, well, I saw this on the internet and it worked perfectly for their baby, so that's what I need now. And I'm like, well, have you talked to your doctor about it? Well, no, but this is what we need. And that, I mean, even just as a parent coming from this place of, please, please, please ask professionals, because people get caught up in it and they're so sure. So that's my own little PSA, like, please ask a professional.
And, you know, we always call that N of one, right? You know, my N of one, my child, my, and so when we think about data, it's never look at an N of one. But that being said, I have heard, again, from parents that say, well, I did bring it up to my pediatrician, or I did, you know, mention it, and they either brushed it aside or didn't think it was an issue. And I think that that kind of speaks to the lack of really good studies and data and evidence and education out there. And that's, again, where I'm passionate, and I feel like we need to get some of this information out there. I think even just with this project that we're hoping to disseminate the information, we can talk about the thousands of babies actually we take care of, which, you know, and help add to that literature. And I think that's where there still needs to be a lot of work. And so, you know, Marcia works in this field. We have great ENT, you know, colleagues, but not every physician or every clinician around the country is as familiar, I think, with this. And so I really do think our role of those who do this a lot is really to get this information and the data out there to support what we do, because I think that really will help turn the tide medically as well.
And I think families can be great advocates for their children in providing good documentation to their providers. You know, I tried to nurse the baby for, you know, 20 minutes, and my pain level was here. And or if the baby's bottle feeding. So the baby takes 45 minutes to finish a bottle because we can't keep the nipple in their mouth, and they can't, and they're gagging with the nipple in their mouth. And those are things that the families can use to talk to the providers about. Something's not going well here. And I don't necessarily think families should come to the provider and say, we need a release. We need a tongue tie release. But let's talk about what's happening, and then let your provider help you get to the next step. And if they're not offering that, I don't think it's inappropriate to ask for, might we look at this? And to have an evaluation and another provider say, no, this isn't really something, but here are things that we can do to help you out, might answer or resolve some of those issues for a family. And certainly I think families have come into my office and have been very frustrated with responses from their provider because they've had concerns. But again, I think you should be an advocate for your child. Mm-hmm. But I certainly think you need to look at what your child is doing and not what you see on social media and compare. Babies don't read the books and how they're supposed to do all of this stuff. But as a parent, we need to figure out what our baby's doing.
Sure.
And then help them kind of move forward from there.
I love that advice, Marcia. I think being on the receiving end of somebody saying, well, this is actually what's happening, rather than coming in with the plan in mind and not demanding, but asking, I think helps both the parent and the provider come up with the next best solution, whether it's an evaluation from a specialist who does see this more often to say yes or no, this is an issue. And I think, you know, in the age of social media, pediatricians have a hard job, right? Like, they are hearing all the misinformation and everything. And when parents come in, not always advocating in the manner in which may be most effective, I think that is a really good tip to say, this is objectively what's happening. How do we work together to move on and help the baby?
I think that's excellent advice. And we have made it all the way through the list of questions that I had prepared for us. And I'm so grateful for this conversation we've had. Thank you both. Could we maybe wrap up our conversation with just some words of wisdom, some words of advice that you might share with families who are experiencing this and feeling a little lost? What would you share with them?
I would say, talk to your providers, ask questions, try to learn. Sometimes it's not the baby that's having some challenges. Sometimes it's us, the parent, positioning. So sometimes we just need to look at other options. And for families, parents that have had more than one child, maybe what worked for baby number one doesn't work for baby number two or baby number three. So sometimes the experienced moms will say, gosh, this worked well for my other babies, and now it's not. And so I think asking questions, being willing to learn and gain some additional knowledge, maybe taking a deep breath and trying to relax through this. I understand the overall concern about the baby's feeding issues. And these babies typically are crying and they're angry because they're hungry, and they're not getting that need satisfied. But being able to try to group your resources through your provider and other professionals to see if they can give you some tools to help with that. That's what we love to do. We love to help families. Mm-hmm.
I totally agree. And I will use my N of three here. So I'm a mom of three. My first two breastfed like champions and my third was awful and I was cracked and bleeding. And, you know, I've been doing this for a long time. And so I understand where parents are. And if my third had a restrictive tissue that, you know, I thought could be taken care of, I probably would have jumped on that in a heartbeat. And maybe not having the background knowledge, I may have sought other resources to take care of something that may or may not have been in his issue. But I'll echo what Marcia said is that, you know, advocate for your kiddo, but breastfeeding is hard. And I think tongue ties can certainly play a role, but they are not the be-all, end-all. And so certainly utilize your resources, like Marcia said, but don't be afraid to speak up and ask about it too, because I think we're all learning. So Marcia said, you know, you're learning as a parent, but I think as medical providers, we're always learning as well. And so just staying up to date on all the information is super important, but don't give up. I think it's worth it in the long run.
And just one other little caveat. I think the challenge with breastfeeding and or bottle feeding, certainly for some of these babies are born with issues that create challenges for the work that it takes to take a bottle or to nurse from a breast. To release that tissue for some of these babies can be so much more detrimental to their overall health. So I think seeking out your provider's input and not just going out on your own and seeking input from other providers who may not necessarily know all of your child's medical history, then you could be creating a little bit more of a problem than you're fixing. So just, I think, you know, work with your providers. And if I would say, you know, I mean, I certainly think that there are probably cases where I've had families talk about that I don't have a good relationship with this provider. It may be worth looking at a different provider in the practice or and or just having a discussion with that provider. Where are we not connecting on this? But I think we just need to be open and have a conversation.
Yeah. That's great advice.
Just one final thought is that I already mentioned this, but there are different ways to release that tongue. And we have not had any complications with the releases in the hospital besides some minor bleeding. Whereas I do think those seeking releases through other means and when kiddos are older, as Marcia mentioned, certainly can be detrimental. And so really using evidence to kind of guide what we do in the hospital as providers, but also, you know, having those parents trust us as well is super important. And that's kind of our main goal is to say, I hear you. I know what you're saying. We're here for you too. We're all in this together, and we all want the best outcomes for these babies.
That's an excellent way for us to leave this conversation. Again, thank you both for being here.
Of course, thank you.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Young and Healthy. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you next time. This episode was recorded on April 10th, 2024. The Young and Healthy podcast is for informational and educational purposes only. This episode was produced by Kayla McNeil, and our theme music was created by Stephen Greco.
Thanks for listening. Follow Cincinnati Children's on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter.